Hello, and thank you for joining us today for this CMEO snack, where we will explore the multifaceted roles of GLP-1 receptor agonists. We want to thank CME Outfitters for producing this educational activity, and note that it is supported by an independent educational grant from Novo Nordisk. We may talk about some off-label use of medications today, but we'll be sure to point that out when it is, so that you know that's the case. I'm Dr. Jay Shubrick, a professor and a primary care diabetologist at Touro University, California. I'm delighted today to be presenting with Dr. Amy Rothberg. Amy, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Jay. I'm Dr. Amy Rothberg, and I'm a clinical professor of metabolism, endocrinology, and diabetes, and also research professor of nutritional sciences at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you, Jay, for hosting this event with me.
I'm delighted to have you here. We have just one learning objective today: to identify the multifaceted impact of GLP-1 receptor agonist therapies on glycemic control, cardiovascular health, weight management, renal health, liver health, and overall type 2 diabetes complication risk. So it's a packed objective. So to get us started, we have a case. And again, we want to know, would this be a case where you may or may not consider the use of a GLP-1? So JP is a 54-year-old Asian female who had a heart attack 1 year ago. She presents to you today to talk about medications for weight loss. Her past medical history is significant for hypertension and atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. You note the MI from 1 year ago. And you did some labs, and her hemoglobin A1C was 6.0%. We might need to add prediabetes to her medical history as well. Her BMI is 25, and her eGFR is 68 mLs per minute, and her UACR is less than 30. So we'd like you all to think, is this a patient you would consider a GLP-1 receptor agonist for?
Jay, let's review some of the misperceptions and try to address them, and feel free to chime in. One of the misperceptions is that patients must fail metformin before using GLP-1 receptor agonists. This is not the medical reality. In fact, GLP-1 receptor agonists can and often should be used as the first line in patients, particularly at high risk for cardiovascular disease, or who have an underlying, as you said in the previous slide, renal risk. Another misperception is that GLP-1 receptor agonists cause pancreatitis or thyroid cancer. These are indeed very rare adverse events, and patients are counseled or should be counseled about the very rare but potential adverse event. Let me just say more about that, and this will be addressed later. We're talking about a rare form of thyroid cancer called medullary thyroid cancer, which represents less than 5% of all thyroid cancers. Indeed, most thyroid cancers are of the kind called papillary thyroid cancer, and GLP-1 receptor agonists are not associated with that type of thyroid cancer. Another misperception is that they're only for weight loss in severely obese individuals. That's just not true at all. They're highly effective in overweight individuals with at least one weight-related comorbidity, and those individuals have been studied across many trials. Another misperception is that side effects are intolerable for most patients. Indeed, there are GI-related side effects, but these are generally dose-dependent or occur at the initiation of the drug and are usually transient in nature and only mild to moderate in severity. The cardiovascular benefits are only related to weight loss. Well, there are a lot of benefits that are indeed related to the weight loss, but there are both direct vascular and metabolic effects that are independent of weight loss.
And I'd love to highlight a couple of things you said. I think it's so important that you covered these things. You know, there are guidelines now that are recommending these agents as the first treatment of diabetes. And so I think it's important to say that we really have changed that paradigm. And if you have someone who has, let's say, established diabetes and they have a compelling indication, you're supposed to make room for these agents. So in fact, they're encouraged to be inserted into treatment. So I love that you talked about it. And I do think it's very important that we go over the warnings with these medications, albeit they're quite infrequent in terms of the serious warnings. All I do is a history and physical for my patients. There is no medical monitoring needed for GLP-1 receptor agonists. So there's no lab test to be doing. There's no special test to be done, as long as you take a nice history and physical and make sure they don't have any contraindication. And then finally, I loved what you said about the side effects. It is so important that people know that this is rebooting our abilities to feel satiated. And so it's so important that we know that we have to kind of reboot the way we eat. You know, typically I eat a meal in about 4 minutes. That's not the way my body has been made to sense food and feel sated. And so I think it's important for us to say, we need to work with this medicine so that we can be successful. And most people actually feel quite a bit better when they're kind of letting their body do their thing. So I love the points that you brought up.
Well, Jay, on the heels of that, let's talk about mechanism and the physiologic impact of GLP-1 receptor agonists, some of which you've already discussed. We know that these work in the brain at GLP-1 receptors. In fact, GLP-1 receptors are ubiquitously found. But in the brain, they activate hypothalamic GLP-1 receptors. By doing so, and we'll talk about this a bit later, or maybe I'll even spend some time talking about it now, they can also decrease neuroinflammation. But while working on hypothalamic GLP-1 receptors, they facilitate, as you said, or enhance early satiety, and they suppress hunger. They also make it possible for people to be less responsive to the food cues that they were otherwise more responsive to. For example, they have just less or fewer intrusive thoughts about food. And this really facilitates weight loss because people are not ruminating about food. And they eat food, you know, and less of it, and are able to lose weight. We know from the studies, particularly pooled studies looking at GLP-1s for a number of indications, that that they have really slowed down some of the activity that is implicated in diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, and they may indeed have neuroprotective effects, particularly because they protect neuronal loss. Within the GI tract, they do slow down a gastric motility. This is one of the mechanisms by which they work. And in so doing, they enhance early satiety, as I said earlier, making it easier to have a low-calorie diet and therefore weight loss. They also slow down or delay glucose absorption with respect specifically to the stomach. They delay gastric emptying, again, reducing appetite, but also lowering postprandial glucose spikes. At the level of the pancreas, they increase insulin production. This is in a glucose-dependent fashion, and beta cell proliferation. They also decrease beta cell death, and they suppress the counter-regulatory hormone glucagon, which results in better glycemic control with reductions that we have seen in A1C, and they have a very low hypoglycemic risk. The risk really only occurs in the setting of other insulin secretagogues or insulin. At the level of the liver, they decrease hepatic gluconeogenesis, they reduce steatohepatitis and steatosis, and therefore improve metabolic-associated systemic liver disease and MASH. They also decrease mortality. At the level of the heart, They increase myocardial glucose utilization and cardiac output. They decrease oxidative stress and endothelial dysfunction that are tied to the hard cardiac outcomes that we see, and they inhibit cardiomyocyte cell death. This results in the hard outcomes that we see, such as decreasing cardiovascular events, heart failure, and CV mortality. With respect to kidneys, they result in increased diuresis and natriuresis. They induce endothelial expression of profibrotic molecules and increase the availability of intraglomerular nitric oxide. This decreases CKD progression and a risk of end-stage kidney failure.
So you have shared so many different effects of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, and it is amazing how diffuse those effects are. And we're so lucky to have these extra glycemic benefits. And I often tell patients that, you know, when you look at these agents, you're getting really that integration of the cardio, kidney, metabolic, and liver systems that all work together in a abnormal pathophysiologic mechanism in type 2 diabetes. And you can really get at them and improve the physiology across all these organs, which I love. I think, again, this is really taking a comprehensive, holistic approach. And the other thing you said that I just want to give a shout out to is that many people, particularly those who are thinking about it for the use of obesity in the absence of diabetes, is that they cause a glucose-dependent insulin secretion. And so people I often have will ask me, well, it's going to make me drop low. And it's not the case, right? In fact, our body is very eloquent at making sure our sugars do not drop low. And this works with our body system. So this is something that, quite honestly, is a potent glucose-lowering agent, but has the safety, unlike many of the others, such as insulin and other insulin secretagogues like sulfonylureas.
Thanks, a very good point indeed, Jay. So let's turn and just look at what's occurred over the course of the last couple decades. Here I'm just showing you the FDA-approved GLP-1 receptor agonist, starting with the approval of exenatide in 2005, followed 5 years later with the approval of subcutaneous daily and injectable liraglutide, and then 2 years later, the extended release once weekly exenatide. In 2005, it was twice daily administered a drug. Exenatide 2 years later was then followed by the FDA approval for dulaglutide for the indication of type 2 diabetes. And then just 3 years later, we added semaglutide for the management of type 2 diabetes. And then subsequently also for its treatment of overweight and obesity. Then came along oral semaglutide that was a game changer for those who really were needle phobic and just could not consider using an injection. And this was again approved for type 2 diabetes. And then more recently, the approval of tirzepatide in 2022 for type 2 diabetes, shortly thereafter approved for obesity. And we'll talk about the other indications for which these drugs have been approved. As you can see from the table, dulaglutide was approved for the management of type 2 diabetes. And this extends to adolescents who are 10 or older. It also has been approved for lowering MACE in individuals with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease or multiple cardiovascular risk factors. Exenatide subcutaneously twice daily and weekly has only been approved for the indication of type 2 diabetes in adults. Liraglutide has also been approved for type 2 diabetes in adults, but also adolescents starting at the age of 10. It is also approved for lowering major adverse cardiovascular events in patients with type 2 diabetes and established cardiovascular disease. And it was the first GLP-1 that was approved for overweight with a weight-related comorbid condition or obesity in adults, and also for adolescents 12 or older with severe obesity. Let's move on and talk about semaglutide, which has really a panoply of indications, including type 2 diabetes in adults, and also weight reduction, both in adults with overweight and obesity, and again in adolescents who are 12 years old or older. It has been shown to reduce and has the indication for reducing risk of EGFR decline, end-stage renal disease, and cardiovascular-related death in adults with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and also, again, MACE reduction in patients with established cardiovascular disease and either obesity or overweight and without type 2 diabetes. Oral semaglutide, like exenatide, is only approved for type 2 diabetes in adults. And then tirzepatide is approved first for the indication of type 2 diabetes, and then has been approved for managing people with overweight or obesity who are adults. More recently, it has gotten the indication for the management of obstructive sleep apnea in adults, either using PAP, that is positive airway pressure, or who are not using positive airway pressure. Jay, anything to add?
Yeah, I think what a wonderful overview you gave. And I, you know, you've covered that they have multiple different indications. And, you know, I think I want to highlight to our audience, we've had commercial availability of GLP-1 receptor agonists for 20 years. So, you know, often people say, well, these are newer agents. They're actually not that new. We have plenty of experience with them. And many of these other indications have come from extensive studies and large populations of people to show they have extra glycemic benefits. And I think if you're going to be writing these, it's so important to remember that you have to write the medicine with the right brand name, with the right indication. Because at least in California, to get these covered, that needs to be part of the SIG when you write. And I do think it's going to help you all get these medicines to the patients that need them.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah. So let's return to that case. Remember, we talked about JP, who is the 54-year-old Asian female who has a past medical history of hypertension. She had a heart attack 1 year ago, and now she's got a blood test indicating that she's got prediabetes. Amy, what are your thoughts? Is a GLP-1 a medicine you would consider for her, and why?
Absolutely, and I'm enthusiastic about prescribing a GLP-1 receptor agonist for a woman who has established heart disease and also is interested in losing weight. Now, let's remember that thresholds or BMI thresholds for diagnosing someone with overweight or obesity are lower in an Asian population compared to a Caucasian population, for example. She also has a number of other weight-related comorbid health conditions, such as hypertension, an A1C that puts her in the pre-diabetes range, and an EGFR that would put her at having a chronic kidney disease. So I think a discussion around these medications would be appropriate.
Yeah, and I think this patient's coming in requesting weight loss, which again will affect that conversation. But I think that this is a great opportunity to show where we might be thinking holistically about this person, thinking about how do we address all of their comorbid conditions. The person's talking about weight loss, and we really can get the win on both sides in this case, because we want to protect her kidneys. We want to protect her heart. We want to prevent her from getting diabetes, and we want to help her lose weight. And I think this is a great opportunity to include this as a potential option. Now, if you were going to introduce that to her, how would you introduce this that class to her?
Well, let's look at what we just talked about in the previous slides. What are those that are approved or have the FDA indication for heart disease? And really, there are three. dulaglutide, liraglutide, and semaglutide. And I think we're thinking about what would be really the potency related to these drugs. And frankly, we might want to understand, cost considerations, what her formulary would allow. But, I think that because she has established heart disease, that really we would need to go with semaglutide because she does not have, even though I said dulaglutide and liraglutide, semaglutide is the only one that has FDA indication in those without type 2 diabetes, where the other two drugs are approved for those hard cardiovascular or cardiovascular risk factors in individuals with type 2 diabetes. So I think if we're going to do anything, we're going to need to consider starting with semaglutide. Now, that may change over time. What do you think, Jay?
I agree. I think absolutely letting her know that this is one of the treatment options for her. I think that there is, I want to reinforce that we want to not only help her lose weight, I want to help her manage her comorbidities and really prevent conditions as much as we can. In terms of indication, you're spot on, right? But this is someone that actually in the future might have more indications, but based on the current one, semaglutide is a great choice. I also think it's worthwhile for us to think about what other choices we might give this patient. So let's just say that she was unwilling to take an injection. Are there other medicines or other classes you would consider for her?
Well, let's
So is it?
consider a lot of
Sorry.
different options. She is seeking weight loss. So we do know that intensive lifestyle intervention based upon the diabetes prevention program can result in really quite significant weight loss. And because she has prediabetes, she could be referred to, for example, the National Kidney Foundation or CDC Diabetes Prevention Program. There are, of course, other medications used in the management of prediabetes, again, from the DPP, such as metformin, that resulted in a 31% risk reduction in the progression of type 2 diabetes. Certainly, although SGLT2 inhibitors do not have the indication for weight, they might be used in someone who might be predisposed to heart failure and who has chronic kidney disease. And they do result in some modest weight loss. If you're just talking about overall weight loss, there are effective other anti-obesity medications that come in an oral formulation. And with respect to the combination, for example, phentermine to topiramate, that has actually been shown to improve glycemia. So that, and the weight loss is not trivial. There is about a 7 to 8% weight loss with that combination in the moderate and highest doses. So there are many options. And again, as data emerges from the clinical trials of GLP-1s, there may be more and more of these current drugs and emerging drugs that will have the indication for all this cardiometabolic pathology that this particular patient is experiencing.
Yeah, what a great discussion. And I do love the idea of highlighting that if you're going to prescribe pharmacotherapy for this patient, it really should be part of a comprehensive plan. So absolutely, we want to maximize therapeutic lifestyle change in addition to medications. And you know, that could include the diabetes prevention program, that could certainly include medical nutrition therapy, certainly support as well, because we want someone to have a multimodal attack. And I love that you called out that while, at least in the United States, we're very used to having many people have a excessive overweight or obesity, there are lower thresholds in the Asian population. And so this is a metabolically important measurement of overweight for this patient. And so their request for assistance with weight loss is medically founded and supported. So this was really a good discussion.
And Jay, just on the heels of what you just said, I think this is a population that is often ignored, and we need to be paying more attention two indicators of overweight and obesity in this particular population.
Absolutely. So we want to get back with our audience and talk about setting some SMART goals as it relates to this snack. Remember that SMART goals are specific, they're measurable, they're attainable, relevant, and timely. So to challenge you all, we'd love for you to make sure that you can consider at least three outcomes beyond glycemic control that are relevant to the patient population you serve with diabetes or obesity. We'd like you to be able to identify misconceptions that clinicians have about GLP-1s, as well as patients' misconceptions that they might have. And then be able to think about at least two key factors that make a patient a good candidate for a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And when you might suggest that as a treatment for one of your colleagues, but equally important, when is it not a good option for our patients? We hope that you have been able to take that from today's program. You can find more information for you and your patients by visiting the Metabolic Diseases Hub. Please watch the other programs in this series and do not forget to register for our live Q&A with Amy and myself on November 13th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. When you register, you can submit questions to us, and we're looking forward to having a dialogue with you about this exciting area in medicine. If you watch this entire series, not only can you get good continuing education credit, but you can claim a badge as a patient-first diabetes management champion. Please do not forget to take the post-test and evaluation to claim your CME or CE credit. This is important because that feedback helps us to develop future programs. We want to thank CME Outfitters for helping make this program possible, and we thank you again so much for participating.